push the button and off it goes. Today is the 4th of August, 2014, and we're here with Paul and Barbara Schnurr. My name's Tom Martin, and this we are in our house in Flagstaff. And Paul and Barbara, I'd like you to introduce yourselves. Tell me the year you were born, and please spell your names.
Okay, I'm Paul Leo Schnurr, MD, and Schnurr is spelled S-C-H-N-U-R, and I was born on February 15th, 1936.
I am Barbara Schnurr, S-C-H-N-U-R, and I was born on August 13, 1935.
Thank you. Paul and Barbara, what I'd like to do today is focus on the June 30th, 1956 airplane accident between Transworld Airlines and United Airlines. And Paul, if you could tell me what you were doing at the park that summer and sort of set the stage for us.
Okay. Well, let me go back and say that my family first moved to Grand Canyon in 1947. I'm pretty sure it was 46 or 47. And I was 11 or 12 years old at the time. I was born 36, so that would have been 11 years old at the time. Went through grade school. When I got time to go to high school, there was not a high school at Grand Canyon. So one would have to go to Williams or Flagstaff and live with somebody. But there was a boarding school in Utah where most of the kids from Grand Canyon and other national parks went. It was called Wasatch Academy. So I went to high school there, graduated from high school there. And then I went off to college. And of course, all this time I'm living in Grand Canyon with my parents, but going off to school. And so I started college in 1954, and I was at the University of Arizona in Tucson. But I would come home every summer and work for Fred Harvey. And so the summer of 56 was no different. I was in college, but I would come home and I would work for the for Fred Harvey. And this summer, and I would work at different places. I would work at the Kolb's, at the Lookout Studio one summer. One summer I even worked at the laundry. One summer I worked in the gas station pumping gas, but this summer I got a job as a bellhop at the Bright Angel Lodge, which was a real plum job because you got tips. And my family had moved. Okay, keep going.
Paul, can you tell me a little bit more about that job that summer as a bellhop, getting tips? Getting tips doing what?
Okay, let me just tell you this, that my family had moved away from Grand Canyon in 1954 because my father had left the Grand Canyon Hospital and opened a practice in Sedona. So they were now living in Sedona, but I still kept coming back from college and working at Grand Canyon, and I would bring classmates. So I had a whole bunch of buddies that would come up and work at various places. This summer, I got the plum job as a bellhop at the Bright Angel Lodge, which was one of the best jobs, that summer jobs you could get at the Grand Canyon. And I lived in one of the dormitories because my family had moved away. And the job, like any bellhop, entailed being at the lodge, doing whatever they asked you to do in terms of taking ice to rooms, but mainly rooming patients. We're not patients, I'm mixing metaphors now, rooming customers, clients. And they would make reservations at the Bright Angel Lodge. And of course, the lodge was filled all summer long with reservations. There was never any open room. So people would drive up to the front of the lodge, and you're familiar with the lodge. There's a driveway in front of it. As you walk in a door, there's a long registration desk that not only registers people, but it also had a desk where they did took reservations for trips into the Grand Canyon, mule trips, bus rides, all the other things that Fred Harvey offered. And then if you remember looking at the lodge, and it's not a lot different today, if you look at the desk and you look straight ahead, there's this gorgeous fireplace that Mary Coulter designed. The last time I was up there, it was all covered up because they're remodeling it. To the left a little bit as you go around the corner, there is an opening in the wall, and it's the bell stand. And next to that, and they don't have it now, was a gorgeous copper water fountain, drinking fountain. And then if you go down the steps to the left, there was the bathroom. But the bell hop stayed at this check station. It's still there. You can see it. They opened the doors. It was a half door covered with copper, and we would hang out inside. We wore uniforms. We wore Fred Harvey uniforms. They were, as I recall, they were kind of a criminal. They were, I guess the color you'd know today would be burnt orange that the University of Texas has. It was about that color. And you had epaulets and you had brass buttons, and it was all very formal looking as a bellhop. And we hung out there. So, yeah, we wore a cap. We had, as I recall, it was looked like a bellhop cap, you know, sort of round. And so as the customers would check in, the desk clerk would call us. We would go with the customers out to their car, direct them to which cabin they were staying in. Usually we would walk down there and they would follow us in their car. We would then have them park in front of the cabin, and we would help them carry their bags in and then stand there with our hand out. It wasn't quite as common tipping in those days as it is today, so we had to work a little bit for the tips. But, you know, the better you were, the happier you were, the more affable you were, the more you told them about the Grand Canyon and told them about things, the better off the tips were. It just so happened that one of my buddies, who I had grown up with, worked every year at the Bright Angel, and he actually put himself through college working as a bellhop there, made enough money in the summertime to pay for his tuition, room, and board at the University of Arizona.
Who was that, Paul?
His name was Phil Weeks. He's not alive now. His father was a baggage man for the railroad, so he didn't have the money to put him through, where my father was a doctor, so he could afford to help me out with tuition. But this supplemented. But Phil actually put himself through college by working as a bellhop.
Wow.
And he helped me get this job. So those were our day-to-day activities, and we had different rotations. Sometimes we'd come on at 6 o'clock in the morning and work till 3 or 4 o'clock. Sometimes we'd come on at 10, work till 10 or 11 at night. We probably had a bellhop there from like 6 in the morning to maybe 10 at night, and there may have been somebody there all night. And I think, if I remember right, it was one of the permanent bellhops that's worked year-round who would do the night shift.
Did you have tour buses coming in?
Oh, sure.
And you'd have to deal with a lot of baggage all of a sudden.
When the tour buses would come in, yeah.
Coming and going? Did you help them load back up again?
We would, but usually, everybody would come out and help with that. We'd have multiple people. But during the day, there'd be just one or two on at the desk.
Okay.
And then we'd take... We didn't do food service. Somebody else did food service, but we would take ice or other things that people wanted that were there. So that's what I was doing for the summer. It started as soon as college let out, probably beginning of June, maybe even in April, and worked till the end of August. And then there were other people that worked year-round, but they were small in number. So that was basically the job description for that summer. Now, you want to talk about the day of June the 30th, as I recall. Okay, well, it was a day like any other day. Let me preface it by saying, I wasn't a pilot at the time. I ultimately got my pilot's license and got to know the flying people there. But I had gone up in one of the Hudgens planes. I think it was the old Ford Tri-Motor. For my first flight where we flew over the Grand Canyon as a sightseeing passenger. So I knew about the Hudgens because the Hudgens also had their home base in Tucson at the airport in Tucson. I didn't know them well at the time. I didn't really know them at the time. But this day was like any other day. Things were going on as suspected. And then we started hearing about this possible plane crash over the Grand Canyon that there was information, and we didn't have television. There was no television there, but we had radios. But I think the only station we could pick up was Flagstaff and Williams, and They were fairly local stations, but there had been news about a crash over the Grand Canyon. I can't remember the exact time of day, but it was sometimes into the afternoon, and that it had been discovered by Hudgens. And I sort of didn't know what to make of that, planes of that size. But then the most impressive thing to me was the media arrived, media from everywhere.
Was that that night or the next day?
No, it was probably the next day. I don't remember that because they had a long way to come. I mean, some of them didn't come in for 2 or 3 or 4 days. They came from New York. They came from Los Angeles. They came from places like Albuquerque, places like Tucson, but Chicago. All these reporters from big name newspapers. And there was television, not at the Grand Canyon, but there was television. There were reporters there, photographers there, a lot of media photographers, some video photographers. And then later on, media was arriving from London and from Paris and from international. And the most significant thing about it was it created a madhouse because, number one, there was no place for them to stay. There were, all of the rooms were taken by people, by tourists who had reservations. There wasn't anything open to stay. And number two, there wasn't any transportation available for them. They got there by train. They got there by flying into the airport that was being used at that time was the Valley Airport. And at some point in time, there was public flights, scheduled flights into Valley, but I'm not sure there was then. I can't remember for sure.
So would this be Valley out as it is today, or
yes.
was the Red Butte airstrip going?
The Red Butte airstrip was there, but it was only being used. It was essentially a private airstrip. The Hudgens were there. I didn't remember that, but at the dedication, I talked to the son, the Hudgens' son. He was there, and he told me that he was a little boy, and he was living there in a house that the Hudgens were living in. And I didn't know that until he told me that. But I do know that it was the airport that was being used for sightseeing, but not for commercial.
Thank you.
But the Valley, there was flights into the Valley. There were TWA flights into the Valley at some point in time. And I don't think at that time, it may have been earlier or later. So I'm not sure about that. But charter flights could have come in there. People came by the rail. Mostly they came by train or they drove. They might have flown into Phoenix. But remember, this is before jet aircraft. So that to fly across country, when I was a freshman in college in 1954, my roommate was from New Jersey, and he invited me home for Christmas. And we flew from Tucson to Newark, New Jersey, in a TWA Constellation, like the ones that crashed. And it took about 12 hours. I mean, we couldn't do it nonstop. We had to stop in Chicago to refuel because it was so any reporters who came by air would have had to travel a long time. And then if they flew into Phoenix and rented a car, it was a long drive up there, and there were not many car rentals in those days. In fact, I just don't even remember car rentals. But they would, at that time, to drive from Phoenix to Grand Canyon was 6 or 8 hour, maybe even longer drive. So it was a long time to get up there. But they showed up. All these people showed up. And miraculously...
I'm just curious, did Fred Harvey, did anybody have an inkling that they were coming?
Certainly not before the crash. And then I think it was a matter of them walking up to the desk and saying, I need a room.
Got it.
And the desk clerk saying, I'm sorry, sir, we don't have any rooms. There are no rooms available. And they would say, where can we find a place to stay? And they'd say, there's no place to stay here. And the media are not shy, so they started demanding places to stay. And I think Fred Harvey, I can't remember exactly what they did, but there was a lot of finagling and moving, and I don't think they were canceling reservations of tourists. They may have, because media found places to stay eventually, but they didn't have any transportation. And as we were just talking, the center of search and rescue, although I don't think it was called search and rescue then, was out of the Red Butte Airport, which is how many miles from Grand Canyon? 10 or 12? I mean, it was a good drive. It's not something you could walk or drive.
That's right.
I mean, it's not something you could walk or ride a bike. But these people didn't have any transportation. You know, there were no rental cars there. There were no taxis there. Fred Harvey had cars, but they cars and buses, but they were all being used for tourists, and they didn't want to interrupt the tourists, you know, the tourists that were coming there. So these people needed to be able to get back and forth, and they needed to be able to get around to, you know, at that time Bash's was not Bash's, it was a Babbitt's store was where you could buy stuff. And they needed to get to places where they could file their reports by telephone. And so those of us that had cars, I was fortunate that I had an old 1950 Ford that I'd gone to college in. And so I had this 1954. So I and other the bellhops and other people around would rent our cars. I mean, we didn't rent them to them. We drove them. So we acted as chauffeurs, and they paid us. I can't remember whether we fixed prices or we just told them whatever they thought it was worth. But when I wasn't working, I still had to work, but when I wasn't working, I would run people back. I would hang around the Bright Angel Lodge or even go up to the Alto Bar. They would say, you know, I need to get out to the airport. I need to get down to Babbitt's store. And I and others would run them around in the car. So,
how did that work, Paul? How did you connect with the fact that these people were milling around looking for transport?
Well, of course, they would come to the bellhop and they'd say, I need to get out to the airport. How can I get there? Where can I get a cab? Where can I rent a car? You know, where can I find transportation? And I would say, well, I have a car. I could take you out there during my lunch hour. I could take you out there, you know, at a time, and then I'd start doing it. And then they knew that I had a car, so they'd come to me and say, you know, can you run me out there tomorrow morning? And other people that had cars would do the same thing. Yeah, if you have a little water, that. Okay, that's great. So it was just really word of mouth that we would connect with all these people. And then usually if I head out to the airport with one person, three or four more would come up, you know, in front of the Bright Angel Lodge and say, if you're going to the airport, can I go with you? And I remember the frustrating thing in taking them out to the airport was that, we're working all right?
I think we're good.
Okay.
I was just going to put this on pause if somebody starts leaving.
Yeah, this, okay. As we all...
Your cell phone in case it rings, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just turn it off. Okay. I'll just put the volume down. Okay, so let's see. Where was I? Okay, so we'd run several people out to the airport. And the frustrating thing, you know, I'd get in the middle of all the conversation because the search and rescue or the investigation, as we know now, and this was kind of vague at the time, Hutchins really discovered this. He went out in the morning with a tourist group and saw some smoke and thought it was a fire and came back. And then when he heard that these planes were missing, he went back out and found the wreckage. So soon on we knew where the wreckage was. And when we went out to the airport, there was just a lot of discussion about how to get down there. Planes were flying over. I remember them searching to see if they could see any movement down there with the idea that there were anybody still alive, and they flew over. No helicopters then. It was just fixed-wing airplane. And there was a lot of discussion about trying to fly over and see if there was any movement down there. And as I recall, after a day or two, they decided that they saw no movement, so that there was no survivors that they knew of. But they still wanted to get people down there. And I don't remember the Swiss climbers that came. I've learned about them before, but I knew that they were trying to get people down and that it was a remote area and it was not near any of the trails. I knew the trails because I had hiked the trails a lot, and I knew it wasn't near any of the maintained trails. And then I do remember all this discussion about getting a helicopter. And there weren't any helicopters available in northern Arizona, but they could get one out of Fort Huachuca, that was the military down there, and that was the Army, and there was Army aviation down there, that they had to truck the helicopter up because I don't think it could fly up, or at least they didn't want to fly it up, so they trucked the helicopter up. And I do remember the helicopter coming, and I remember just one helicopter I remember. A lot of discussion about who was going to go down in the helicopter, the preparation to go down in the helicopter. I've subsequently seen pictures of this helicopter. I don't remember it at the time, I just remember the helicopter, but I've seen pictures of it, and it looked like a fairly sophisticated helicopter. It had double props, so it looked like the modern Huey. It looked like an older version of the modern Huey. So that's a pretty substantial helicopter. But I remember, because I was out there with these reporters, and I remember they all wanted to get on this helicopter. Every one of them was demanding that they get on the helicopter. I'm from the New York Times, I got to get on. I'm from the London, whatever the newspaper is in London. You know, I'm from the LA Times, I'm from the Wall Street Journal. I'm from ABC, NBC, I need to get on this plane. So finally I remember, after all this discussion and a lot of shouting and browbeating, that they sat down and they said, okay, and I don't know who decided this, obviously whoever was heading, you know, up the whole operation, said, we'll take one reporter and we'll take one photographer, and you guys decide who that's going to be. So there was a lot of scrambling there. You know, I'm the biggest newspaper, I'm the most important newspaper, I'm the biggest magazine. So finally, after all this discussion, they sat down and drew straws for one photographer and one reporter, and I don't remember who they were. I can't tell you who they were. But the first helicopter flight that went down took one reporter and one photographer down, and they went down and they landed, and they were there for I'm not sure how long. But then when they came back, they confirmed that there was no survivors, that everybody was dead. But then all of the reporters and photographers got together to share the information with the two who went down there. And then that went out to the media all over, because they sent it all out by telephone. They got on telephone and filed their information.
Did you know if they jammed the phone system out of the park? Because there must have only been a few lines in out of the park at the time.
You know, I don't remember that as a specific, but, you know, living in Grand Canyon was really primitive in those days. And I would suspect that could have been a problem. Okay. Certainly no cell phones then. So then as time went on and there were more helicopter flights that went down, I think they took more reporters and more photographers down. And this went on for 2 weeks, just exactly 2 weeks. Every day running people back and forth, whenever I wasn't working, lunch hour, on a break, you know, if I had a coffee break for 15 minutes, I'd run somebody out and run somebody back. And so it was fairly lucrative for a young college student. And then suddenly, the reporters were all gone. 2 weeks, they just disappeared overnight. And any idea why? What can you think of happened 2 weeks after the crash?
Help me, Paul.
Okay. It was another pad crash. It was a ship collision off Nantucket. It was the Andrea Doria and the Stockholm. And they had a huge mid-ocean collision of these two ships with injuries and a lot of problems. And so the reporters virtually were gone within a matter of 6 or 8 hours. We were down to nothing by this time, because by this time pretty much everything had been sorted out. They knew there were no survivors. They were starting to plan evacuations. I think the evacuations were underway. So the big stories had been told. I'm sure a few reporters stayed, but all the big-time reporters were gone, and we were sort of back to normal in terms of that activity. But the feeling of the people who lived there was, you know, pretty traumatic. The people who worked there, the people who worked in the restaurants. I mean, that's who we were all. I mean, there were people who worked for the railroad, or people who worked for Fred Harvey, or people who worked for Park Service, and that was virtually all the people who lived there. And they were pretty traumatized. You know, I'm trying to remember just how everybody felt, but I'm sure it was like New York. after 9/11 that sort of we'd been violated by this accident. All these deaths have occurred in Grand Canyon, the peaceful, wonderful Grand Canyon. And, you know, we all have one objective at Grand Canyon, and that's to give the tourists, I say one objective, the Park Service has another objective. They have to object to maintaining the park at certain levels, but certainly Fred Harvey and the railroads and even the Park Service, their primary objective is to making it a worthwhile experience for the people who are coming there to visit. And certainly there were not as many people in those days as there are today that came and visited, but relatively speaking, there were a lot of people came, and they came by train. Lots of them came by train. But that was in the transition from everybody coming by train to everybody coming by car. And we were sort of in the transition where the train would come in every morning and it would be full. But there'd be lots and lots of cars that were coming and people that were staying there. And, you know, we had to continue on taking care of these people and yet deal with this terrible thing that had happened and all that went on. And then, as I recall, as the summer went on, it sort of quietly became part of the scene, and life went on after a number of weeks, and most of the bodies had been evacuated, and they were then thinking about clearing up the wreckage, and that became more in the background discussion. Certainly I wasn't involved in that, working for Fred Harvey at the Bright Angel Lodge, and so that went on, and the summer went on, and by the end of summer, by the end of August, beginning of September, I went back to college. But it's been an indelible memory. I mean, Barbara can tell you that all the time we've been married, which is 51 years now, she's heard about this accident, and it comes up in conversation. And it didn't really take such a front place in our lives again until this time for it being made a National Historic Site came up, and we were invited to come as part of the Historic Society and volunteer and meet the people. And so for the very first time, we met the families of these people. And I had the experience at one of the dedications of meeting one of the sons of one of the passengers, who told me that he came up as a child with his family and stayed at Bright Angel Lodge. And I was very surprised at how he got a room at Bright Angel Lodge. But I can't tell you this for sure, but the Harvey people must have done some maneuvering to try to take care of everybody.
So that was the first time, that was this summer,
yes,
that you were aware that there was actually family at the South Rim in 1956.
Yes, yes. I had no idea that the families had come. I mean, even though I was there and I was working at the Bright Angel Lodge, I do not remember that families came, families of the passengers, the victims came. And it wasn't until this gentleman told me that he had been there as a child that I realized that the families were there.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Do you know if the Park Service or Fred Harvey or the railroad put any people up, reporters or family, in their houses? I'm just trying to figure out where all these people went.
Yeah. Of course, my family wasn't living there at the time. We had a house on Navajo Drive, but somebody else was living in that house by the time this happened. I was living in the dormitory, but I do not recall people staying in homes. But I do know that these people all got put up. And another summer, I worked at Kachina Lodge. This was a summer before this summer. I worked at Kachina Lodge. And if you remember Kachina Lodge, at that time, it's had different names. Grand Canyon Inn, it was called. But when I worked there, it was called Kachina Lodge. And it was the lodge that was on the old mine, the old uranium mine. It was the...
It was up on the hill.
Yeah, on the West Wind Drive. I worked there. And, in fact, I managed it. I was in high school, and I managed the lodge for the summer. My parents' friends had bought the lodge, and they were looking for a manager.
Oh, gosh.
They met me, so here I was a senior in high school, and they asked me to manage it, which it's hard to believe. I was managing the bar, and I couldn't drink. But anyhow, so I faced all summer long this thing about people coming rolling in at 6 and 7 and 8 o'clock at night without a place to stay, and we were completely full. So we put up tents in the back. We had probably 8 or 10 tents that were like old army tents, you know, with wooden sides in the tents, and they had a bunk in them. And we'd finally say, well, we don't have any rooms, but we do have a tent if you want to stay in the tent, and you can use the bathrooms in the lodge. And we'd usually fill those tents up. So okay. There may have been something like that. There may have been tents put up somewhere or some sort of, I don't remember that. But, you know, I do remember they were all there and they had a place to stay eventually. But it was maybe 2 or 3 days of turmoil because there were no places for them to stay.
Okay. Do you have any other observations of what was happening, what struck you as curious or interesting out at the airport when you take the reporters out there?
Well, there was a lot of activity going on out there. There were a lot of planes there. The Hudgens were there, and I think they were involved, but I don't think they were running the operation. I think the military was there, and they had military aircraft there. I later got to know that airport better because I became a pilot and I flew my small airplane. And I never landed at that airport, but I'd fly over that airport on the way to landing at the new Grand Canyon Airport or landing at Valley. But I do remember lots of aircraft there, and I remember this episode of, you know, the helicopter. We need a helicopter. We can't get down there without a helicopter. And can a helicopter get down there? You know, everybody was aware of all the drafts and the squirrely winds that occur down in Grand Canyon, and the fact that an aircraft can get down and get caught in downdrafts and not be able to overcome the downdrafts because they don't have enough power. So I think there were a lot of anxiety about that with the helicopters. But obviously, as we've talked about, this helicopter in retrospect that they had was a pretty beefy helicopter. So that may be why they trailered it up, because they needed a military helicopter with the most amount of power. And I can remember, I can't visualize the helicopter, but I remember seeing the helicopter there. I didn't know about airplanes or helicopters. I'm much more interested now, or at least when I started flying, but I remember a helicopter, because I don't think I'd ever seen a helicopter before. Mm-hmm. I think that was the first time I'd ever seen a helicopter.
Do you know who the doctor was at the South Room at the time?
You know, you asked me that question once before, and I should have found the answer, but I don't. When my dad left, they had 2 or 3 doctors in succession that didn't stay very long. And right at that time, obviously there wasn't any need for medical attention except for some of the reporters or anybody that was there that might have been hurt or gotten sick or whatever. But I'll find that out and let you know.
I just kind of wonder what the impact was of the hospital staff once they heard this disaster happened. What did they do to spool up for this? And then basically stand down, and there were no survivors. But
it's possible there wasn't a doctor there, and it's possible that it could have closed as a hospital by this time, because I know after my dad left, they had a couple of doctors there that just didn't work out. It just, you know, it wasn't a good fit, and there may have been a period of time in there where they had decided to just run clinics and not have a hospital. But I can maybe find that out and get that information available.
Okay. How do you think the accident affected the people of the community?
Well, as I said before, I think the community was devastated. The community sort of focused on taking care of tourists, and this was something totally different. I think that, you know, at first it was an accident of such proportion that it was hard for people to fathom. I mean, two huge, for that day, aircraft colliding over the Grand Canyon and people and bodies falling into the Grand Canyon. Certainly there was the sadness for, you know, I think we thought about their families who were at far distant places. And as I say, I certainly wasn't aware that the families were there, but I'm sure other people were aware that they were there. And I'm not sure exactly what all they did while they were there, whether they were involved in identifying the bodies or, because ultimately the two grave sites, the two mass grave sites in Flagstaff and Grand Canyon occurred, and there must have been a lot of preparation for that, which I was not involved in, so I didn't have any appreciation of that. But certainly there was this sadness, there was this feeling that how could something like that happen over the Grand Canyon? I think there were anger that these planes collided, and you know, why should they collide? Why, you know, why did two commercial airlines have such an accident when at that time we had modern aviation, even though it wasn't jet? I think we all knew that airplanes flew because we'd see them. We certainly knew about little airplanes because the old Ford Tri-Motor was a standby, and that was, you know, it was almost a joke. It was a funny-looking airplane. It was made by Ford. It was made out of corrugated aluminum. It was almost a comical airplane, but it was the ideal airplane for sightseeing over Grand Canyon because, you know, it cruised at 50 miles an hour and had big windows in it, and so we were all aware of that aviation. I think the big aircraft, you know, we just didn't think much about them. But the people, I think, were pretty devastated by it. They were sad. As I say, it was probably a little bit like New York City after 9/11, although it wasn't local people that were killed. Whereas in New York City, it was the New York City people who were killed. So it was brothers and sisters of people who lived there. Here, they were all distant and unknown, and so they didn't have a personal feeling. But, you know, I think you could just think about people laying in the bottom of the Grand Canyon all torn, and then there were stories of finding watches and finding wallets and finding all the paraphernalia around that, you know, were attached to those people. That was, you know, now we're sort of used to huge aircraft accidents like that. We, you know, they don't. Still, it's the safest means of travel, but when it happens, it's always big news, and there's always a lot of detail, and you know, the report, the media loves to take an aircraft accident and just look at every single detail in the aircraft accident and show pictures of sadness and small details that evoke emotion that's part of the media. I think we all had that then, maybe for the first time. I mean, those of us who were living then and were old enough, I was 20 years old, remember World War II, and we remember all the people that were killed and all the devastation of World War II. This was small potatoes to that, but, you know, what was this? This was 10 years after the end of World War II. So, I mean, we all listened to the radio and heard about all the troops that were killed and saw pictures in Time magazine and Life magazine, and we'd go to the movies and they'd have these movie reels and it would show the devastation of the war. So we were used to that. But this was close to home, and this was not a war, this was an accident. So I think it traumatized them. But, you know, it didn't last a huge long time. I mean, it's certainly not like New York City, where here we are 13 years after that accident, and it still probably is real in people's memories in New York City as it was 2 years after. But I think this, people gradually sort of, when things got cleaned up, we got back to the normal routine because it wasn't loved ones of people who lived at Grand Canyon Village. We got over it. We got back to taking care of tourists and seeing that they got a nice experience, and they got the mule rides, and they got bus rides, and they got a chance to see the canyon.
Yeah, that makes sense. So this summer was the dedication of the National Historic Landmark.
Yes.
Uh-huh. What are your thoughts on who you got to meet, and how did this dedication impact you?
Well, let's ask Barbara. She made one of the first contacts. We, of course, since Barbara and I are members of the Grand Canyon Historic Society, we got calls to volunteer. So we volunteered to help at one of the first receptions on the 30th. And we found out that there was going to be the ceremony at both the Flagstaff and the Grand Canyon Airport, and since grave sites. And since we were living in Sedona, we thought it would be better to hit the Flagstaff one first and then head on up to Grand Canyon. So we drove up to the Flagstaff one. I didn't know where it was. I had never seen it. And I had no idea. It's basically on the NAU campus.
Citizens Cemetery.
Yeah, I thought I was going to go to the back of a dormitory, and there's the cemetery there, and there's the mass site. I'd never been there. I knew about it. I'd seen pictures of it, and I knew it existed, but I'd never been there. So we got there and asked Barbara. She made the first contact.
May I say that Paul and I were married, well, we met in 1961. And so, of course, I was not on the scene here in Arizona in 1956. And we were married in 1963. So we have been married 51 years. And for all
we
those,
were almost married to the day of the accident.
So in June 29th, 1963. And so for all of these years, I have heard many, many, many times Paul talking about the accident at the Grand Canyon. It really is and was very much a part of his memory and in his thoughts. On occasion, we had attended some talks, one in particular in Prescott at the museum, when these talks were given about the accident, Paul made it a point that he would attend because, and with me, of course, because this accident was really very much a part of his memory. It affected him in ways, certainly in emotionally a different way than the children of the passengers and crew, but nonetheless, it affected him, when he told me that this site would become a national landmark, and that we were invited to participate, he was very much interested in being a part of this event. And as he said, we first went to the cemetery in Flagstaff on our way to the Grand Canyon on that day. And the first person that I met and said, you know, good morning, hello, introduced myself, and she said, I'm so-and-so, and my father was the pilot of TWA Flight 2. So you can appreciate how I felt thinking of the strong, strong emotions of the day. That day, plus the day that followed in, was it July 8th?
I think it was July 8th, yeah.
Those 2 days.
That was the official dedication.
Yes, the official dedication certainly will remain with us forever. And especially to me, because now I have experienced a little bit more of the actual happening, and we heard in those 2 days of the experiences and and what many of them were children who have this memory etched in their in their minds or memory and will stay with them, of course, forever. Okay, so
And following up on that, we did have a chance to make contacts with some of the families. One of the feelings was at the Flagstaff Cemetery. They asked the families if they would like. Were you at the Flagstaff one?
No, I was at the one here at the cemetery at the South Rim.
Okay. The Flagstaff one was very formal. The Park Service almost made it like a military one. I'd never seen Park Service Rangers march and salute. I never thought of them as paramilitary, but they went through the commands and they carried the guns and they carried the flags, just like military salutes would be. And then the superintendent wasn't there, but there was one, I think, an assistant superintendent there who was conducting this, and he asked all of the family members to come up and take a rose and put the rose on the grave. And then he asked if they wanted to say anything. And this lady that Barbara befriended, the daughter, she went up and they all said a word or two, not a lot. And then a gentleman went up and, you know, it's kind of gray haired with a gray beard. And he started talking about losing his father in that accident. And he, you know, with tears in his eyes and a shaking voice, talked about how it affected his life not having a father, growing up without a father and living a fatherless life, and how it made his life less than what he would have wanted it to be. He was really emotional. And so Barbara asked me if I wanted to say anything, the fact that I was there, and I thought that that was so insignificant compared to what they experienced that it was not a proper thing to do, to go up and say, well, I was there and I participated in the things, but it was just, you know, compared to what they experienced. And then when we had the reception, you were at the reception up at the Grand Canyon, and we had there were several people who told their story. There was a lady who had written it beautifully wrote the story, but sadly told how it had affected her life. And then there was another gentleman who got up and spoke extemporaneously about how it had destroyed his life. His mother had was killed in an automobile accident. His brother committed suicide. You know, that really brought things home. And then in the July one, there was a fellow that had written the book. What was the book called? Going In, or We're Going In?
Yes, I think that's right.
And he wrote a chapter. He read a chapter out of that. And I was taken because I'm. And then the other thing it brought home was the connection these people had. Surprisingly enough, a lot of them worked for TWA. They were part of the TWA, and they were flying on this aircraft from Los Angeles to Chicago because they had operations in both places. And so this fellow who wrote the book was a Chicagoan, and I love Chicago. I spent a lot of time in Chicago when I was working on my professional association because the headquarters is in Chicago. I love the Chicago accent. Everybody lives on our block, and Scottsdale is from Chicago almost. And he's a very typical Chicago sort of a fellow. He wrote this article, or the book he wrote, he read a chapter from it, very Chicago-oriented look at the event and the effects that it had on him and the effects that it had. So it really brought back the profound effect that it had on all these people who were members of the family.
And I might add the effect that it had on Paul.
One surprising thing to me was that it would be made a National Historic Site, because you usually think of it as something marking, you know, I guess a historic thing that's maybe upbeat and creative and adds to society. Well, this added to society, but in a very negative way. So At first, I really was surprised that they would make it. And then I was surprised to find out that there are like 8 or 10 National Historic Sites in the Grand Canyon. I was surprised that they were landmarks, yeah. And then as I thought about the significance of the history of this, but it's going to have a very different effect on people when they see this as opposed to some other sites. But I guess if you look at, you know, you go up to, I'm sure, the Little Bighorn where Custer was, you know, annihilated is a fairly significant historic site because it's certainly talked about in history extensively. And I think the site will be too.
Yeah, it seemed as though what we need to remember, yes, it was a national tragedy, but it spurred Congress on finally to start the Federal Aviation Administration.
Absolutely.
And the skies today are as safe as they are, as you mentioned. There's nothing safer.
Safer way to travel, yeah.
No safer way to travel. Because of this tragic loss. And so we honor these people and their families, the Gandhis, Captain Jack Gandhi, her daughter, two-way pilot. We honor these people and their sacrifice for future generations of the country and all flyers around the world. A huge significance.
Sure.
In that regard. I think that may be how the park came at it. Like, wow, this is really... It's a big deal.
Yeah, it certainly has been a big deal in what it's done to aviation. One of the things that I was a little surprised and I anticipated was that with all these family people there, that there might be an animosity between the families of the passengers and the families of the pilots, with the idea that in some way the pilots may have been responsible for this accident. And I didn't sense that. I didn't see that anywhere. It may have been undercurrent. But I didn't see it anywhere. I didn't see it in talking to people, in listening to people talk, in seeing what they had written. I saw nothing about the families of the passengers feeling animosity towards the families of the pilots. Because I don't know what the FAA, or it wasn't the FAA, it was the CAA, determined was the cause of the accident, but it probably had to be pilot error.
The final report cited both. Well, there were a number of errors, but they cited both pilots in error.
Yes.
They cited, if I get this right, the United pilot was in error for being at the wrong altitude, or the other way around. The TWA pilot was at the wrong altitude. The United pilot was in error because he approached the TWA plane from behind and did not avoid it, meaning he saw it. He started to take evasive action, but he was too late and hit the plane in front of him. If you rear-end someone with your automobile, the person in the back is, I mean, failure to control your vehicle. So, basically, it was a no-win game. But that was my take on it. It was a tragedy for everyone. And
sure.
And the guy in front shouldn't have been in front. He was hit by the guy behind who shouldn't have hit the guy in front. There it went.
But if they're not in IFR, which they weren't, it's CNBC, and you know that's what the pilot is, the CNBC. But
in VFR, flight rules.
Yeah, but sometimes
CNBC.
Yeah, sometimes it's not easy. I can tell you personally that you're scanning the sky and there may be an airplane, something show up that you didn't see in your scan.
Do you remember the weather for that day?
I think it was beautiful. I mean, I can't remember whether there was, but in reading, it was a very clear, beautiful day. I mean, reading the report, I read the report of Hudgens finding it, and that's why in what I've read, when he went out and flew and he was coming back, saw this whiff of smoke, thought to himself initially, oh, there's been another lightning strike that started a fire, but it's such a remote area, I don't need to worry about it. Then he gets back, and he hears on the radio that there are two planes missing. And then and this is from my reading, then he thinks to himself, well, there aren't any clouds in the sky. It's a clear, beautiful day. There shouldn't be a lightning strike. I better go back out there and take another look, which is what prompted him to go back out and take a look and find the crash site.
Barbara, what else are you thinking about this? What else would you like to add?
Of course, it's given for Paul and me. We have certainly thought a lot about the event of 1956. But as I looked around at all of the children and family members of the passengers and crews of the airplanes, I thought that I had a positive feeling about the day and the fact that this event all came together in the way that it did. I'm thinking the word, it's used maybe too much, but closure is a word that came to my mind, thinking that that the people present had they must have come away after all of the these days that everyone was together, with a feeling in their hearts that there was the positive, as you mentioned, that came out of it, with the FAA that came into being, and that the skies are safer for all of us because of that particular happening. And so I came away with with some positive and good feelings, good in quotes, after having had an opportunity to be present with all that of this ceremony. And so that's what I would like to say.
You know, in thinking about these people, Barbara talked about a closure, and maybe there's a closure, but it doesn't change the effect it had on their lives. And that was my first real experience. Subsequently, being interested in aviation, I've followed subsequent, you know, at that time it was the worst aviation accident in history. And then when I was living in Tucson practicing, the Tenerife accident occurred, where two 747s were in Tenerife, and one was taking off and the other one was
on the ground,
taxiing. Yes, right. And the one taxied in front of the one that was taking off, and the one taking off tried to clear it but didn't, and these two 747s collided on the ground with, I think that was at that time the largest fatality. And subsequently I had a chance as a physician to take care of one of the patients. Of course it happened a long way away, but one of the patients happened to live in Tucson, and he had been treated. He had bad burns from this accident. He was a survivor, obviously. And I think he'd been treated at Brooke Army Hospital Burn Center, which is the largest burn center in the country, because he had extensive burns. And it was like maybe 5 years after the accident, and the insurance company had fairly compensated him fairly well, and he had gotten back to a fairly normal life. But the insurance company said you needed to be checked out because we're not going to support you after 5 years. So we want you to see a physician and see if there's anything more that needs to be done. So they sent him to see me as a plastic surgeon and to see if there was any more work that needed to be done before the insurance company was going to write it off. And there really was. And he had been well taken care of and been well reconstructed. And he had had virtually everything that could have been done to reconstruct him to optimum. So I had a chance to meet him and get to know him. And then I had another experience. You may remember there was an accident of a plane leaving Detroit, I think on its way to Phoenix, it crashed on takeoff out of Detroit. And the personal experience there was that One of the vice presidents of the University of Arizona, his name was Swede Johnson, and he was a friend of mine. When I was an undergraduate, he had been head of the student union, and I had stayed in touch with him and stayed friends, and I was involved in the University of Arizona because I served a term as president of the National Alumni Association. And Swede was a big Sigma Chi, and his son was a big Sigma Chi. And they had had their annual meeting in Detroit that summer, and Swede and his son met there for the Sigma Chi convention. And so at the end of the Sigma Chi convention, Swede took his son to the airport and put him on this plane to fly back to Phoenix. And Swede was taking another plane someplace else, and the plane took off, and his son was killed. And so, you know, knowing Swede and commiserating with him over the loss of his son, a fraternity brother at a fraternity meeting was pretty traumatic. And then as a private pilot, we've had two close friends who have been killed in small airplane accidents, and you realize the profound effect that that has. And when you take 28 people, and you look at the profound effect that's going to have on all those lives. But the difference was that it being at Grand Canyon, and they had come from, you know, Los Angeles on their way to Kansas City and Chicago, we didn't know or meet any of these people until the ceremonies this summer.
That's right. Anything else about this event?
Barb, can you think of anything else?
I don't think so.
I have to say that I thought the ceremony held out at on the 8th was a very, very moving ceremony with the Park Service and with the superintendent there, and people from the FAA and people from the Park Service, and the importance that that was given. It must have been comforting to the families to see the importance. And the media sort of threw it in a little bit. We talked to the media. We saw coverage of it on the evening news in on the Phoenix media, but I don't know that it got any national media coverage. But it was an impressive ceremony, I thought. Beautiful setting. I can't think of anything else.
Okay, thank you so much for your time remembering this, and I sure appreciate it.
Okay.
Thank you.
I bet you've gotten